3rd of January 2013, it is highly likely that he believed he would never be called upon to deliver it. Up until polling day in 2015, his best chance of staying in government involved a second coalition with the Liberal Democrats, who could be relied upon to veto the proposal. His words that day, "I am in favour of a referendum. I believe in confronting this issue, shaping it, leading the debate, not simply hoping a difficult situation will go away," did not reflect any particular clamour from the country. In the month prior to the 2015 election, EU membership had come 10th in the pollster Ipsos's monthly monitor of voter concerns. Significantly, the same polling showed Labour enjoying a 4-point lead over the Tories on voters' confidence in their ability to handle asylum and immigration. Rather, Cameron was trying to appease both his party's Eurosceptic fringe and more moderate Tory MPs fearful of the growing threat to their own seats posed by UKIP. Even George Osborne was opposed to the idea, but Cameron rolled the dice regardless. Apparently too arrogant to realise that with Murdoch, Dacre and The Telegraph all determined to leave the EU, they were loaded. Nevertheless, when he won the election and was compelled to deliver on the referendum, it was still eminently winnable. In retrospect, it is a miracle that the losing Remain campaign did so well. Cameron's leadership was catastrophic, his campaign a catalogue of missteps and miscalculations. The first and the biggest was the failure to understand, never mind communicate, the strength of the deal that we already had. As head of the Foreign Office in 1991, John, now Lord Kerr, had secured opt-outs on both the euro currency and the social chapter. From a Eurosceptic perspective, we had the best deal going. Poignantly, Kerr also drafted what would become Article 50 in order to allow a dictatorial regime to storm out of the EU and said, when Theresa May triggered it, "I don't feel guilty about inventing the mechanism. I feel very sad about the UK using it. I didn't think that the United Kingdom would use it." Kerr's colleague in those negotiations, the former Europe Minister, Tristan, now Lord Garrel Jones, said something in 2009 that perhaps explains why Cameron's own colleagues failed to appreciate the scale of the risk he was taking. After Cameron's withdrawal from the EPP signalled his first capitulation to cranks and crackpots, Garrel Jones observed, "It is now a tradition in Britain that all the major parties in Britain behave badly on Europe in opposition, and they all behave fairly sensibly when they get into government. Cameron is a sensible, clever, thoughtful young man. If he becomes Prime Minister, he will behave in a sensible, clever and thoughtful way and in the best interests of Britain." In the event, he did no such thing. Whether through his assumption of British exceptionalism or arrogance or both, the idea that he would be able to extract more concessions from the EU was doomed from the start. At every stage of Brexit, both before and after the referendum, the idea that we merited special treatment was as daft as it was damaging. Whether it was David Davis insisting that the German car industry would allow us to retain all of our trading heft despite quitting the trading bloc, or countless commentators intoning that they need us more than we need them. There was an almost psychological inability to accept that, as a member of a club, we would be expected to abide by the rules and requirements of membership. Cameron's attempted renegotiation was effectively an early iteration of the same delusion. But if Cameron's arrogance in calling a referendum was unsurprising, his inability not to foresee the epic disloyalty of his fellow Eton alumnus Boris Johnson may be more of a shock. We will see that Johnson's decision at the 11th hour to move against Cameron was motivated entirely by self-interest. But while the rest of the country was not yet fully familiar with Johnson's epic ego and deep dishonesty, Cameron, as a former school friend and fellow member of the Bullingdon Club, had no excuse. Similarly, Michael Gove, if David Cameron could not navigate the Brexit sensibilities of his closest friends and colleagues, then what chance did he have of steering the country to safety? Gove, a Murdoch lifer, married at the time to a male columnist who is godmother to Cameron's youngest daughter, was almost the embodiment of media enmity to EU membership, and yet Cameron was completely blindsided by his betrayal. If he hadn't suspended collective cabinet responsibility, it is also possible that neither Gove nor Johnson would have risked the careers they had in pursuit of the ones they wanted. The appointment of Craig Oliver and Will Straw to run Britain Stronger in Europe, the clumsily named official Remain campaign, looked lightweight and complacent in light of the heavyweight ogres they were lined up against. Oliver was an uninspiring BBC man turned communications director, while Straw was the affable son of former Labour Foreign Secretary Jack. And putting the almost invisible Stuart, now Lord Rose, a former CEO of Marks & Spencer, in charge of the whole campaign looks, in retrospect, like an act of deliberate sabotage. I should have said no, he admitted in 2021. Instinctively, I didn't think it was for me. I felt strongly about remaining in Europe, but I didn't think I was the sort of person who should lead that campaign. But sadly, nobody else would volunteer, and I was lent on and persuaded, and I weakened, and I took it. Again, hardly a ringing endorsement of the man making these decisions, David Cameron. Cameron can't be blamed for the uselessness of Jeremy Corbyn, who not only refused to share platforms with Conservatives, but also gave the later confirmed impression of being a leaver in all but name. But it was his job to accommodate it. He can categorically be blamed for the circumstances that left him unable to counter the immigration lies and exaggerations of both the official Vote Leave campaign and the Farageist Leave EU, when they very deliberately portrayed Polish builders or Romanian neighbours as the cause of British voters' financial discomfort. Cameron and his colleagues could hardly turn around and explain that the real source of their difficulties was the Conservative austerity policies pursued with Victorian vigour since 2010. Worse, countless regretful Leave voters have told me on the radio since the referendum that they voted both in expectation of ending up on the losing side and, crucially, of punching David Cameron on the nose. Perhaps most importantly, a man who had spent years rubbishing Gordon Brown's economic forecasts and predictions was unable to counter the media insistence that any economic forecasts or predictions of Brexit problems, almost all subsequently realised by reality, were just project fear scaremongering. Tim Bale of Queen Mary University of London, quoted early in this chapter, identifies another reason for Cameron's failure. Hoping and believing that Remain would win, Cameron was so anxious about putting the Conservative Party back together again after the campaign that he pulled his punches when it came to criticising Tories on the Leave side, refusing again and again to fight fire with fire. Indeed, it often appeared that Cameron, so capable of casual cruelty at PMQs, turned up for a knife fight with a pair of battered boxing gloves and a dog-eared copy of the Queensbury Rules. Apart from the personal and largely short-lived career advancements of a few key players, I still don't know what leavers think they won. By the second decade of the 21st century, any talk of increased prosperity and imminent improvements to the cost of living, of sunlit uplands and enormous injections of cash for the NHS, of cheaper food, cheaper energy, and amazing new trade deals with unspecified new lands had largely disappeared. Instead, they now insist that blue passports and vague notions of improved sovereignty were the real prizes all along. Either that or the unhappiness of people who opposed the madness from the start. Or increasingly they argue that Brexit could and would have been brilliant were it not for the failures of the people charged with delivering it. Such bilge is sustained and remains largely unchallenged due to a combination of lies, media complicity, and a deliberate detachment from the truth from those at the very heart of government. It is ironic that a Remainer, through incompetence, arrogance, and patrician complacency, did more than any Leaver politician to break Britain. Trouble started brewing for me in my third year at Eton, recalled David Cameron in his autobiography. Due to my growing sense of being slightly mediocre, a mild obsession about being trapped in my big brother's shadow, and a weakness for going with the crowd, even when the crowd was going in the wrong direction. Tragically for the rest of us, by the time David Cameron elected to go into politics, he believed he had changed. Chapter 7. Jeremy Corbyn. In general, his intellectual CV gives an impression of slow-minded rigidity, and he seems essentially incurious about anything beyond his immediate sphere. Martin Amis. Everyone likes him, even people who thought he was a left-wing loony. John Landsman. On the 22nd of February 2012, a Conservative MP called Stuart Andrew retired to the Strangers' Bar at the House of Commons for a nightcap. He had lunched earlier with Prime Minister David Cameron and expected to pass a convivial but uneventful evening with fellow Tory MPs Alex Shelbrook, Guido Bebb and Andrew Percy. Instead, he would shortly find himself bleeding from the nose after being headbutted by a fellow parliamentarian. This contretemps inadvertently helped to set in motion a chain of events that would see the Labour Party led through an era of unprecedented political importance by a man spectacularly ill-equipped for the job. To understand how that could happen, and how the leader of the main opposition party would end up waving through Brexit and oiling Boris Johnson's passage to a historic majority, is to understand how Jeremy Corbyn got there in the first place. It is not clear precisely what prompted Eric Joyce, then the Labour MP for Falkirk, but drink had been taken, and his frenzied attack on Andrew and three others was preceded by a bellowed complaint that the bar was full of fucking Tories. What followed was, even by the standards of an occasionally rowdy drinking hole, a shameful display. "I was having a lovely evening, chatting and relaxing," recalled Stuart Andrew. Andrew Percy came back to the table and said, "Excuse me, can I just get to my seat?" But Joyce would not let him. He said, "There are too many Tories," and pushed him against the wall. I stood up and said, "You can't do that." A police officer restrained Joyce briefly, but, having been released, he headbutted Andrew in the face. "The police held him, but let him go for a minute," Andrew added. "He just went for me and headbutted me on the nose. My nose was bleeding heavily. I kept holding it and grabbed a tissue from somewhere." Joyce also attacked Tory councillors Luke McKenzie and Ben Maney before turning on the Labour assistant whip Phil Wilson, who was trying to calm him down. The following month, Joyce pleaded guilty to assaulting the four men. He was banned from pubs and restaurants for 3 months, subjected to a weekend curfew, and ordered by magistrates to pay a total of £4,400. The former soldier, who was suspended by the Labour Party immediately after the incident, had already announced his intention not to seek re-election in 2015. The competition to replace him as the Labour candidate in Falkirk prompted the changes to party rules that ultimately allowed Jeremy Corbyn to become leader against the express wishes of the vast majority of the Parliamentary Labour Party. Given that his leadership would veer between the appalling and the absurd, it seems grimly apt that its origins lie in an episode of appalling absurdity. Shortly after Joyce's resignation, the chairman of Unite the Union in Scotland, a former shop steward called Stephen Deans, became chairman of the Falkirk West Constituency Labour Party, CLP. He began recruiting fellow Unite members to join the CLP and, entirely legitimately, the union started paying their membership fees. By February 2013, the total membership had soared from fewer than 100 to more than double that number. Under Labour Party rules at the time, every member was eligible to vote in the process to select the new candidate. The union's choice was a former nurse called Carrie Murphy, a Unite activist who at the time worked in the office of the Labour MP Tom Watson, himself a former flatmate of Unite General Secretary Len McCluskey. Allegations that the union was trying unfairly to finesse her passage to the candidacy were denied by Unite, but a leaked December 2012 document contained a self-congratulatory account of contests the union claimed to have directly influenced. It described its work in Falkirk as exemplary, stating, "We have recruited well over 100 Unite members to the party in a constituency with less than 200 members. 57 came from responses to a text message alone, followed up face-to-face, a collective effort locally, but led and inspired by the potential candidate." In a typical example of recondite Labour Party procedure, the selection process was referred to the Labour Party's National Executive Committee, NEC, which in turn recommended that it be scrutinised by the Labour Party Organisation Subcommittee. As a result of the NEC investigation, Murphy withdrew her name from the selection process and, along with Deans, was briefly suspended by the party in June. In July, Labour leader Ed Miliband called in the police to investigate whether criminal activity had taken place. Police Scotland shortly concluded that it hadn't. Deans and Murphy were reinstated, but Miliband's grip on his party looked perilously weak. Tom Watson resigned as Labour's election coordinator, and even Eric Joyce, whose drunken violence had set the whole process in motion, stuck his oar in, saying, "It is a nonsense, and I am afraid the way it has been handled by the Labour Party headquarters is nothing short of disgraceful. The Labour leadership have shot themselves in the foot and created this media storm over what is a genuinely irrelevant issue to ordinary workers. We believe they have handled it absolutely amateurishly, and they have played into the Prime Minister's and the Coalition's hands. They must be rubbing their hands at this." They certainly were. Prime Minister David Cameron immediately availed himself of the opportunity to resurrect claims of Labour politicians being puppets whose strings were pulled by union barons. The rhetoric may not have carried the same heft with voters as it had done in the 70s and 80s, but right-wing newspapers could still be relied upon to demonise trade unions and exaggerate their influence. Similarly, Tory politicians had never tired of pointing out that the unions accounted for around 80% of Labour's funding or that they controlled half of the votes at party conference. Cameron used the old accusation to particular effect at PMQs on the 3rd of July 2013, saying, "His questions are written by Len McCluskey," and branding Miliband "too weak to run Labour and certainly too weak to run the country." Bruised by Falkirk, and in the hope of fending off future accusations of being in the pocket of union barons, Ed Miliband proposed a major change to the relationship between unions and the party. At constituency level, unions would no longer be able to stack a local deck by paying the CLP subs of members. The changes at national level were to prove more significant. Previously, individual trade unionists were automatically affiliated to the Labour Party. They could opt out if they didn't want to be, but the default position was that union membership entailed party affiliation and the attendant voting rights, unless it had been formally rejected. Miliband himself had relied upon union support to beat his brother David in the 2010 Labour leadership contest. His most fundamental change to the existing system essentially replaced the opt-out with an opt-in. For just £3, anybody could effectively join the Labour Party as a supporter. On the one hand, this watered-down version of One Member, One Vote, OMOV, seemed close to a distillation of democracy itself. On the other, it would reduce Labour MPs with decades of parliamentary experience or trade unionists with activism in their blood to the same level of importance as a newly minted £3-paying supporter when it came to, for example, electing the next party leader. On the 1st of March 2014, at a special conference in London, delegates backed the reforms by 86% to 14%. Despite delivering critical speeches and warning against further dilution of union party links, Labour's three most powerful union leaders, Unison's Dave Prentice, Unite's Len McCluskey, and the GMB's Paul Kenny, all backed the plans. It was an impressive victory for Miliband. "He is not always the most inspiring leader," wrote The Guardian's political correspondent Andrew Sparrow, "but at party management he is proving superb." It was also a shining example of the wisdom of the warning to be careful what you wish for. Just over a year later, Miliband was defeated by David Cameron in the 2015 general election. Crucially, Cameron defied the polls to win an overall majority and was newly unencumbered by Liberal Democrat coalition partners. To look at it another way, he was now hostage to his headbanger appeasing promise to hold a referendum on EU membership and about to be embarrassed by his ludicrous pledge to secure unspecified improvements to our membership, already the best available from a Eurosceptic perspective. Following Miliband's decision to step down, the election of a new Labour leader would determine who would be fighting alongside, or at the very least in cooperation with, the Conservatives campaigning to remain. Or so pretty much everybody presumed. The story of what happened next begins, for our purposes, in 1983. Having campaigned on a manifesto that Shadow Cabinet member Gerald Kaufman would later describe as the longest suicide note in history, the donnish hard-left Labour leader Michael Foot was routed at the ballot box by Margaret Thatcher. Among the new intake of Labour MPs were three young unknowns: Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, and Jeremy Corbyn. At least as relevant to the events of 2015, however, was Tony Benn's experience in Bristol East. The veteran left-winger's Bristol South East constituency had been abolished by boundary changes, and having lost the contest to stand in the winnable new seat of Bristol South, he fought Bristol East instead and lost to the Conservative candidate. This meant that the iconoclastic standard-bearer for the Labour left, who had come within a percentage point of beating Dennis Healey to the deputy leadership just 2 years previously, was in the political wilderness until he could secure a new seat. Crucially, It left him ineligible to stand in the leadership contests prompted by the post-election resignations of Healey and Foote. So it was that when Neil Kinnock and Roy Hattersley launched their leadership bid from the party's centre ground, the left found itself without an obvious champion. For a young Jeremy Corbyn, as recalled in Ben's seminal diaries, this was no accident. Kinnock lost the deputy leadership for Tony in 1981, deliberately and specifically, and he was busy preparing himself for the leadership campaign during the general election. There must be a left candidate. Some may detect familiar strains of bitterness, victimhood, and an affinity for conspiracy theory here. Others, no doubt, see an analysis of unimpeachable ideological purity. Ben's diaries, incidentally, are remarkable and frequently delightful. Of Ralph Miliband's funeral at Golders Green Crematorium in 1994, he records, "Anyone on the real left of any significance was there." Jeremy Corbyn couldn't make it. The left now found itself in the Labour Party wilderness for over three decades. Crucial to understanding what happened after they unexpectedly and almost accidentally gained control of the party in 2015 is the fact that key players like Corbyn, John McDonnell and future Momentum founder John Landsman, still arguing in 2018 that Ben would have squeezed Kinnock out if he'd been in the 1983 leadership contest, did not dedicate themselves to licking their wounds during this period. They kept the wounds open, waiting, often it seemed with absurd optimism, for another opportunity to present itself. This seems to me to be crucial for understanding the view of party politics held by Corbyn and his closest associates. The enemy within demands just as much attention and energy as the enemy without, if not more. This led almost inexorably to a cultish Corbyn following that concentrated their fire at centrists and Blairites in their own party to the extent that campaigning for Remain or opposing Tory governments of unprecedented awfulness seemed to be regarded as merely an unwelcome distraction. The key Corbyn adviser Landsman, previously a chief fixer for Tony Benn, is a particularly pertinent case study here. Indeed, in many ways, he is the central figure of the whole saga, which is explored in depth in David Cogan's richly detailed Protest and Power, The Battle for the Labour Party. For while Corbyn remained peripheral to both the national and the party picture until the moment of his arrival on the leadership ballot, Landsman sometimes seemed to be lurking behind every pillar, waiting for an opportunity to grab the reins of power. An ardent Bennite who also worked for Michael Meacher, the doomed candidate the left finally turned to in 1983, it was Landsman who persuaded a reluctant Corbyn to run in 2015, and Landsman who managed to secure the requisite nominations from Labour MPs with, legend has it, seconds to spare. A pivotal figure here was Byron Taylor, a Labour councillor in Basildon with a trade union background and connections to both the Socialist Campaign Group and the Trade Union and Labour Party liaison organisation. John Landsman and others were pessimistic about the prospects of identifying a hard left candidate who might get onto a ballot featuring favourites Yvette Cooper and Andy Burnham. After all, John McDonnell, who would become Corbyn's shadow chancellor, had withdrawn from the 2010 contest after failing to secure the requisite number of nominations. Taylor, however, had something of a revelation while recalling that Jeremy Corbyn had been the only MP happy to help a lost cause candidate in his constituency during the general election campaign. "I thought, it's got to be Jeremy. Jeremy's got to win. He's the man. I mean, it was desperate stuff, but Burnham was in the city talking to business and making clear he was going down exactly the same route as New Labour and Ed Miliband had done." Landsman, crucially, was convinced. Byron said, "Jeremy Corbyn. Jeremy's got no enemies. He will get on the ballot paper." And I thought, I've never taken Jeremy even remotely seriously. Byron was not a rabid left-winger. He was a trade union bureaucrat who had been a party bureaucrat under New Labour, and he was saying Jeremy Corbyn would get on the ballot paper. And it just made me think, actually. I mean, he hasn't got enemies. Everyone likes him, even people who thought he was a left-wing loony. When Landsman succeeded in securing Corbyn a place on the leadership ballot at the 11th hour, this harmless loony reputation would prove to be the most powerful weapon in his arsenal. As director of the Labour Party's Constitution Unit, Declan McHugh worked on the reforms that had been passed so spectacularly at that special conference in March 2014. He wrote later, Ironically, the system was intended to stop a candidate who could not command the Parliamentary Labour Party, PLP, reaching the ballot. In response to the dissolution of Electoral College, including the MP's selection, the nomination threshold to enter the contest was raised to 15% of Labour MPs. Consideration was initially given to a higher threshold of 20% or 25%, but that was rejected on the grounds that it would narrow the field too much. Members from both the Blairite and campaign group wings of the party favoured a lower number. Nonetheless, 15% was judged to be a safe barrier to any outsider, especially someone from the hard left. That judgment proved to be mistaken. It most certainly did. Keen to convey at least the impression of a broad church of candidates, Labour MPs who had absolutely no desire to see Corbyn become their leader added their names to his list of nominees. Three London mayoral contenders, David Lammy, Sadiq Khan and Gareth Thomas, signed up at the last minute because, with one eye on their own election prospects, they wanted to see Corbyn's simplistic strand of anti-austerity politics represented in the contest. Before Corbyn had even secured his famous victory against Andy Burnham, Yvette Cooper and Liz Kendall, John McTurnan, a former adviser to Tony Blair, suggested that the moronic MPs who nominated Jeremy Corbyn to have a debate need to have their heads felt. He added, they should be ashamed of themselves. They're morons. Former Foreign Secretary Margaret Beckett, one of those nominators, agreed that she had been a moron for backing him. We were being urged as MPs to have a field of candidates, she explained. At no point did I intend to vote for Jeremy myself, nor advise anyone else to do it. In addition to what we might call the moron factor, there are three key components to the Parliamentary Labour Party's epic miscalculation. First, the popularity of the £3-a-vote supporter scheme. By the time of the ballot, nearly 200,000 people had signed up for it, and Corbyn was the only candidate with a link to it on his campaign website. Second, the quality of competition. Corbyn may have been widely perceived inside the PLP as a largely well-meaning crackpot, little of his more questionable conduct and associations was known at this point, but nobody on the ballot held particular appeal for people outside it. Bigger beasts like Alan Johnson and Harriet Harman had ruled themselves out of the running early, while Ed Balls, for example, had managed to lose his seat. Andy Burnham and Yvette Cooper had been in Gordon Brown's final cabinet, while Liz Kendall was an avowed Blairite. These previous affiliations would prove crucial to the third factor. Corbyn, or at least Landsman's deft packaging of him, was nakedly populist, and so able to capitalise on the contrast between himself and more normal politicians. The more disillusioned people are with the status quo, the more political capital can be accrued by promising to change it. And because Corbyn had spent his entire career quite sincerely seeing Labour colleagues as the enemy of his politics, he was uniquely placed to trash the legacies of Blair and Brown while promising nothing more substantive than difference. It was, perhaps, the first political cult of personality to be led by a man who had little discernible personality. It was, nevertheless, an extraordinarily effective leadership campaign, capturing the imagination of increasingly dispossessed young voters and their increasingly disillusioned older counterparts. It caught Corbyn's rival candidates, most of the media, and the whole New Labour movement completely by surprise. I wonder now whether the fact that Labour had recently been in power had bred complacency. Figures at the centre of the party expected their more middle-of-the-road policies to have enough appeal to lead them back to power before long, and this blinded them to the intoxicating nature of promises to upend the status quo. The attraction of a radical alternative would have been greater in the context of austerity policies, seen by many as deliberately and unnecessarily cruel. Parallels with Donald Trump are surprisingly apposite here. For the avoidance of doubt, at a personal level, Corbyn is obviously nothing like the secret-stealing, sex-offending election fraudster, but at a purely political level, any candidate who embodies a rejection of the entrenched political system and promises immeasurably to improve the lives of ordinary people can be unstoppable in the right circumstances. And the more desperate a certain type of voter is for unspecified but glorious change, the less likely they are to dig too deeply into its plausibility. As a career-long outsider, Corbyn could be cast in complete contrast to the managerial politicians who had dominated the party for years. The ludicrously Tory-leaning media ecosystem described in earlier chapters had long spawned a sort of subconscious self-censorship among ambitious Labour politicians. Just as Miliband was desperate to diffuse the perception of the party dancing to the union's tune, so the popular and wholly inaccurate refrain that Labour governments were profligate perhaps prevented him and his colleagues from mounting the stinging attacks on austerity that much of the country and almost all potential or past Labour voters wanted to see. For many, this surfeit of caution has reached an apotheosis in Sir Keir Starmer, and it remains a key indicator of the difference between what is needed to win control of the party and what is needed to win control of the country. Landsman, and later Seamus Milne, the Guardian journalist who became Corbyn's executive director of strategy and communications, understood that Corbyn's platitudinal idealism worked well online or in front of adoring crowds, but not under robust scrutiny. So they studiously steered him clear of broadcast studios and ensured that his campaigning, and later his leading, were confined almost exclusively to contexts where he was comfortable and unchallenged. And it worked beautifully. "All over the country, we are getting these huge gatherings of people," Corbyn told a standing room only crowd in Euston, North London, in early August 2015. "The young, the old, black and white, and many people that haven't been involved in politics before." A clearly gobsmacked BBC reporter in attendance that night wrote, "On this Monday evening, so many people have turned up, some supporters are left standing in the street scouting for spare tickets. It feels more like the build-up to an album launch than a political meeting. For those unable to pack into the hall, Corbyn ends up speaking from the roof of a waiting fire engine." In order to understand the cultishness that followed, it is important to imagine the euphoria that those present must have felt. Here, it seemed to them, was a man entirely at odds with traditional perceptions of politicians, saying exactly the same things about wars, wealth distribution and the NHS that they said to each other in their online chat rooms, CLP meetings and festival tents. That he was, in many ways, a walking cliché at his happiest operating the office photocopier and putting leaflets through constituency letterboxes would not have occurred to them. Like all populists, he secured a core following of people who tied their identity so tightly to their perception of him that no criticism was permitted and no self-reflection indulged. By now, the Labour establishment was comprehensively spooked. A week after the supposedly dark horse candidate hopped off that fire engine, Gordon Brown became the latest senior Labour figure to warn against the dangers of a Corbyn victory. On the 16th of August, he gave a 50-minute speech to party members and invited journalists at the Royal Festival Hall in London. While he did not mention any candidate by name, there was no doubt who he was talking about. Labour, he argued, must be credible, radical, sustainable and electable to help people out of poverty. And yet there was one candidate, he explained, whose own supporters did not believe their man would win the next election, meaning everything would be even worse if we leave ourselves powerless to do anything about it. The problem was that Brown could be simultaneously right and damaging to his own cause. For Corbyn's growing base, every attack from the centre enhanced their man's reputation, up to and including critiques of his deeply dubious past associations, by now emerging almost daily. "Don't tell me that we can do much for the poor of the world if the alliances we favour most are with Hezbollah, Hamas, Chavez's successor in Venezuela, and Putin's totalitarian Russia," thundered Brown, preaching powerfully, but largely to the choir. A few days previously, in what would become a recurring theme of Corbyn's imminent leadership, the Jewish Chronicle had accused him of associating with Holocaust deniers, terrorists, and some outright anti-Semites. In an unprecedented front-page editorial, the oldest Jewish newspaper in Britain claimed to speak for the vast majority of British Jews in expressing deep foreboding at the prospect of Mr. Corbyn's election as Labour leader. It continued, "If Mr. Corbyn is not to be regarded from the day of his election as an enemy of Britain's Jewish community, he has a number of questions which he must answer in full and immediately. The JC asked him earlier this week to respond. No response has been forthcoming. In 2023, 8 years after the leadership battle and 4 years after his resignation, Corbyn's most committed rump of support continues to pop up periodically on social media to insist that all reports and criticisms of his well-documented proximity to anti-Semitism were part of a scam and that the often Jewish-controlled media conspired to misrepresent him. It is not the first delusional narrative of bogus victimhood that we have encountered in these pages, but it is the first to come from the left of British politics. It is relevant here only insofar as it illustrates three key components of Corbyn's contribution to the national catastrophe. First, the cultish refusal of his core support to countenance any criticism of their clay-footed hero enabled the Labour leader to fail to turn up for the Brexit referendum and ensured that the Labour Party would approach the catastrophic 2019 election in a state of utter disarray. Ultimately, this created a parallel universe in which lifelong Labour voters, clear that Corbyn had no chance of winning because he had so effectively alienated their friends, colleagues and family members, would be portrayed as the reason for his defeat, while Corbyn himself somehow remained blameless. It was the political equivalent of weather forecasters being blamed for the weather when their forecasts proved correct. Second, the mealy-mouthed and unconvincing way in which Corbyn and his team sought to counter criticism helped to ensure that the single biggest factor prompting former Labour supporters to vote for Boris Johnson in 2019 was, according to all available data, Jeremy Corbyn. And third, both cohorts, leadership and core support, persisted in portraying a deeply hostile and biased media as an excuse for failure, as opposed to an obstacle to be negotiated or even an enemy to be vanquished. This last remains, for me, the most remarkable element of the whole Corbyn episode, suggesting that the media, which, as we have seen, thinks nothing of maligning Ed Miliband's dead father, reserved special vitriol for Jeremy Corbyn, entailed either epic dishonesty or complete ignorance of the extant media political ecosystem. I think the latter description applied to many of his supporters. As he said himself in Euston that night, he was attracting people who hadn't been involved in politics before. Somebody who had never previously encountered the oeuvre of Paul Dacre, for example, could quite conceivably come away from the Mail's reporting of Corbyn convinced that it had unleashed the Furies for the very first time. And that, of course, added to the myth that the establishment was so terrified of Corbyn's transformative powers that it was making things up to harm him. Anybody even half-versed in the reality of right-wing media, however, would know differently, including everybody in the leadership team. They weren't playing to win, they were playing to whine. Consider the alliances with Hezbollah and Hamas referenced in Brown's speech. Asked on Channel 4 News on the 13th of July 2015 why he had referred to the terrorist organisations as his friends, Corbyn showed immediately why Landsman and later Milne were so keen to keep him out of studios. Not only did he lose his temper with the scrupulously equable Krishnan Gurumurthy, almost immediately, he also embarked on an intellectually bereft, barely coherent defence, claiming, "I'm saying that people I talk to, I use it in a collective way, saying our friends are prepared to talk. Does it mean I agree with Hamas and what it does? No. Does it mean I agree with Hezbollah and what they do? No. What it means is that I think to bring about a peace process, you have to talk to people with whom you may profoundly disagree. There is not going to be a peace process unless there is talks involving Israel, Hezbollah and Hamas, and I think everyone knows that." Unfortunately for Corbyn, Hamas certainly didn't know that. Its charter states, initiatives and so-called peaceful solutions and international conferences are in contradiction to the principles of the Islamic resistant movement. There is no solution for the Palestinian question except through jihad. And if that were too nuanced for Corbyn and his "it was a scam" acolytes to comprehend, the charter goes further. The Prophet, prayer and peace be upon him, said, "The time will not come until Muslims will fight the Jews and kill them, until the Jews hide behind rocks and trees, which will cry, 'O Muslim, there is a Jew hiding behind me, come on and kill him.'" It is also worth wondering what role an obscure backbench MP with a long history of defying his own party's whip might have envisioned for himself in any putative Middle East peace process. Not that his core supporters would ever do that. They soon claimed, with characteristic contempt for readily available facts, that he had played a key role in the Northern Ireland peace process. By the time of his leadership candidacy, he had also taken tea on the House of Commons terrace with Raed Salah, sentenced to 8 months in prison in Jerusalem in 2008 for inciting anti-Jewish racism and violence. Described by Corbyn as a very honoured citizen, Salah was also found by a British judge to have used the blood libel, a medieval anti-Semitic trope that claims Jews use the blood of Gentiles for religious rituals. In a speech at an East Jerusalem protest in 2007, he said, "Whoever wants a more thorough explanation, let him ask what used to happen to some children in Europe whose blood was mixed in with the dough of the Jewish holy bread." 4 years later, Corbyn wrote of Salah in the Morning Star newspaper, "The sadness is that his is a voice of Palestinian people that needs to be heard. It's time that Western government stood up to the Zionist lobby, which seems to conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism." In February 2020, Salah was jailed again for inciting violence. In February 2015, a Church of England priest, Stephen Sizer, was banned for 6 months by church authorities after linking to an article on social media entitled, "9/11, Israel Did It," and asking his followers, "Is this anti-Semitic?" The Bishop of Guildford, the Right Reverend Andrew Watson, was pretty clear, concluding that Sizer's campaigning on the Middle East was no longer compatible with his ministry as a parish priest. Corbyn begged to differ, writing to church authorities to claim that Sizer had been unfairly targeted because he dared to speak out against Zionism. Listing these and still more examples of Corbyn's judgment on issues of anti-Semitism, the journalist James Bloodworth, himself a former member of a Trotskyist group, wrote very presciently in The Guardian on the 13th of August 2015, "I believe it shows that the Labour Party and the left more generally no longer take anti-Semitism seriously." The evidence of Jeremy Corbyn's unsuitability for office was as varied as it was considerable. For example, in 1984, he invited convicted IRA volunteers Linda Quigley and Jerry McLaughlin to the House of Commons 2 weeks after an IRA bomb killed five at the Tory party conference in 1984. 30 years later, he could be heard claiming that the USA was launching a proxy war against Russia after the latter had invaded Crimea. More evidence of his unsuitability would continue to emerge throughout his leadership. In 2018, it was reported that 6 years previously, Corbyn had publicly supported Los Angeles-based street artist Mia Wan when his mural, featuring several apparently Jewish bankers playing a game of Monopoly with their table resting on the bent backs of several workers, was due to be removed. Mia Wan wrote on Facebook, "Tomorrow they want to buff my mural, freedom of expression, London calling, public art." Corbyn replied, "Why? You are in good company. Rockefeller destroyed Diego Vieira's mural because it includes a picture of Lenin." Leaving aside the fact that he could neither spell Rockefeller nor the name of the muralist Diego Rivera and all the attendant pseudo-intellectualism, the official party response was typical of Corbynism: incompetent, unconvincing, and begrudging. First, they tried to obfuscate and diminish. In 2012, Jeremy was responding to concerns about the removal of public art on the grounds of freedom of speech, said a party statement. However, the mural was offensive, used anti-Semitic imagery, which has no place in our society, and it is right that it was removed. Then, when this failed to placate Labour MPs like Luciana Berger, Corbyn complained that he hadn't properly looked at the artwork he was defending, saying, "I sincerely regret that I did not look more closely at the image I was commenting on, the contents of which are deeply disturbing and anti-Semitic." Even if you approved of every meeting and association, every misstep and mealy-mouthed apology, you could not conceivably believe that the more widely known they became, the more electable he would become. Rehashing the record any further is pointless. His remaining supporters will be unpersuaded, and his well-evidenced detractors have moved on. Because it is crucial to understanding his broader failure, I have sought to establish here that any suggestion that the case against him was invented is ridiculous, and that his defences of his own behaviour are routinely shrouded in disingenuousness and petulance. and they remained so until the bitter end. In October 2020, after a lengthy investigation, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, EHRC, published its report into allegations of anti-Semitism within the party. Its analysis points to a culture within the party which, at best, did not do enough to prevent anti-Semitism and, at worst, could be seen to accept it. The EHRC also found that Labour under Corbyn had committed three breaches of the Equality Act – political interference in anti-Semitism complaints, failure to provide adequate training to those handling complaints and harassment, including the use of anti-Semitic tropes, and suggesting that complaints of anti-Semitism were fake or smears. In relation to the first type of breach, the investigation found evidence of the inappropriate involvement of Mr. Corbyn's office 23 times in the 70 files it looked at. Corbyn's response was at least consistent with his previous conduct. Half an hour after the report was published, he issued a statement claiming that the scale of the problem was also dramatically overstated for political reasons by our opponents inside and outside the party, as well as by much of the media. He was suspended from the Labour Party and later banned from standing as a Labour candidate. It was an inglorious, if inevitable, end to one of the oddest episodes of party leadership in the history of British politics. Had it occurred during almost any other peacetime period, it would probably have been little more than a footnote, like Ian Duncan Smith's leadership of the Conservatives or Michael Foot and 80s Labour. But while Jeremy Corbyn was aspiring to run the country, despite proving himself signally incapable of running his own party, Brexit was being sold to the British people under egregiously false pretenses, and Boris Johnson was manoeuvring to become the most dissolute Prime Minister of the modern age. Counterfactuals are generally unhelpful, and it would be unfair to contend that any other leader might have somehow steered Brexit into the realms of reality or stopped the Johnson juggernaut. But no examination of how low Britain has been brought can be complete without explaining the role of the man who, more than any other, was supposed to be opposing the dismal direction of traffic. There used to be two ways for non-conservative politicians to negotiate the UK's hideously right-wing media. Either you appeased them in the hope of avoiding their nastiest attacks, or you took the fight straight to them and relied on sympathetic or impartial outlets to get your message out there. Corbyn and his closest advisers invented a third: completely fail to engage, alienate and demonise almost all journalists, claim constant victimhood, and offer up pathetic excuses when confronted with evidence of your own poor judgment. For some observers, Tony Blair and Alistair Campbell adopted too much of the first approach prior to the 1997 election. In 2011, it emerged that Blair was even godfather to one of Murdoch's children. "It's a fair point, and it's a criticism I often think about," Blair told me in 2019 in response to a question about whether their decision not to pick more of a fight with the likes of Murdoch and Dacre had helped to create the environment in which Brexit could happen. "We'd lost four elections in a row and were very conscious of the power of the right-wing media," he explained. "I mean, I think you've got to reflect on that, but it's easy to say when you're not fighting a battle. And, you know, look, although there were certain concessions you might say we made to that wing, there was never any doubt where the country stood on Europe." To date, no Labour leader has tried the second approach. Keir Starmer's determination to pursue non-dom taxpayers suggests that he is happy to earn the enmity at least of the Daily Mail's owner, but his broader approach, as we have seen, entails seeking to defuse traditional criticisms by explicitly refusing to align himself with, for example, striking nurses or environmental protesters. Had Jeremy Corbyn possessed the intellectual capacity and personal skills to carry his convictions to TV and radio studios and defend them with force and charm, he could perhaps have changed the game. Instead, when he found himself under constant attack from right-wing newspapers, he somehow contrived to add broadcasters, such as the BBC and Channel 4, to his list of enemies. Seamus Milne would rarely allow him to be interviewed, and when he was, his inability to defend his record or contradict his critics left him looking petulant and often quite stupid. This combination of stubbornness and self-sabotage, sustained by delusional support, was best described by Matt Seaton in the New York Review of Books in August 2018. He was directly addressing Corbyn's abject failure to handle the anti-Semitism crisis by now engulfing his party, but the analysis holds true for the fatal flaws in his entire approach to getting elected. The article begins with a helpful reminder of how the party appeared to everybody outside the bunker. Earlier this week, I got a direct message from a US columnist I've worked with in the past. It read, "Has Labour lost its mind? Was the party always this anti-Semitic? Or is it just blind fealty to Corbyn? Everything about his support within the party is bewildering to me." The article goes on to pinpoint not just why Corbyn wouldn't handle the matter better, but why he couldn't. It is necessary to understand that his mishandling of the anti-Semitism crisis is not a display of incompetence. It comes from his being unwilling and in fact unable to disavow one iota of the hard left ideology, including reflexive solidarity with any group describing itself as a national liberation movement, to which he has adhered all his adult life. Having spectacularly won the leadership, the first major battle into which Jeremy Corbyn was required to lead his party was the referendum on EU membership. Speaking to Stuart McGurk for a GQ magazine profile and interview with Corbyn in February 2018, a source from Britain Stronger in Europe, the official cross-party Remain campaign group, revealed that they had first sought a meeting with him a month before he won the Labour leadership in September 2015. "Just to say, you know, who knows what's going to happen with the leadership contest," explained McGurk's source. "We'd love to brief you on the campaign." And we didn't hear anything. It would be the following March, a full 8 months after contact was made, before any meeting took place. And even then, it was not with Corbyn, but with a single member of his staff. "Whereas with the broader Labour in team, we were speaking to them every day," the source added. Incredibly, the first meeting between the Labour leaders team and the key cross-party Remain campaign group would also be the last. Corbyn, who routinely voted against closer political and economic ties with the EU as a backbench MP, immediately refused to share any pro-Remain platform with David Cameron because they were not on the same side of the argument. In 2017, Gordon Brown revealed in his memoirs that Corbyn had even blocked plans for a pro-EU rally to be attended by all living Labour leaders because he did not want to appear with Labour's most electorally successful leader, Tony Blair. In the GQ interview, Stuart McGurk draws Corbyn's attention to a claim made by Alan Johnson, chair of Labour's In for Britain campaign, in Tim Shipman's masterful account of the whole Brexit saga, All Out War. Johnson told Shipman, "We kept trying to get Corbyn to say, 'That's why I am campaigning to remain in the EU.' It's a simple sentence. It kept going into speeches and it kept coming out." McGurk asks Corbyn whether the line was routinely removed. His response is typically disingenuous and obtuse. "I don't know what he says was taken out." McGurk, "That's why I'm campaigning to remain in the EU. Corbyn, "I don't know what he's talking about. I stood alongside him in St. Pancras Station and said exactly that about why I'm campaigning to remain in the EU. McGurk, "So Milne wouldn't have taken that line out." Corbyn, "Well, I said it, so it can't have been taken out. I think it's extremely unhelpful and unfair for him to have said that." "After the interview," writes McGurk, "I struggled to find the event where Corbyn told me he said the line. I check in with his office and they send me a link. It was the 22nd of June. The day before the referendum. Until then, in other words, Seamus Milne had apparently succeeded in having the line excised." As is often the case with Corbyn's most committed supporters, those rejecting the obvious criticism that his support for Remain had been at best half-hearted, at worst downright detrimental, ended up being embarrassed by their own allies. "Jeremy, in his heart of hearts, is a Brexiter," said his former shadow Foreign Secretary Diane Abbott in February 2023. "Remember, in the 80s, when both of us were starting out in the party, Tony Benn, who was a huge hero to all of us and a hero to the Labour Party grassroots, he was anti-EU. He saw it as a conspiracy of business people and so on. So that was the common view on the left in the 80s, and I think it's the view that Jeremy still held." Asked if Corbyn voted to leave, as many suspect, Abbott hesitated before saying, "Oh, he would have voted Remain because that was the policy of the party, but not, evidently, the policy of the man." Bizarrely, Brexit would account for both Corbyn's biggest setback as leader and his greatest success. On the 26th of June 2016, 3 days after the referendum result, Corbyn sacked his shadow Foreign Secretary, Hilary Benn, after reports that he had been organising a mass resignation of fellow shadow ministers to compel Corbyn to stand down. "There is no confidence to win the next election if Jeremy continues as leader," Ben explained. In a phone call to Jeremy, I told him I had lost confidence in his ability to lead the party and he dismissed me. There followed what was then the biggest mass resignation in British political history. 12 more shadow cabinet members followed Ben out of the door the following day. By the end of the week, 65 members of his government in waiting had quit, with most citing his handling of the EU referendum as a key reason. On the 28th of June, he lost a vote of confidence by Labour Party MPs by 172 votes to 40. It is worth pausing to consider the scale of opposition to his leadership from people who would have had to campaign to make him Prime Minister. Privately, according to Tim Shipman and others, Corbyn was a broken man, being prevented from resigning by Seamus Milne and other aides. Publicly, a statement was issued denying the constitutional legitimacy of the vote and asserting Corbyn's intention to continue as leader. There was an air of Groundhog Day to the ensuing leadership challenge, and once again, despite enjoying so little support among his parliamentary colleagues, Corbyn romped home when the question was put to the broader membership, securing 313,209 votes to challenger Owen Smith's 193,229. In normal circumstances, the chaos would surely have been unsustainable. Even Barack Obama, asked whether he feared a politician like Bernie Sanders might bring about a Corbynization of the US Democratic Party after Donald Trump's victory, was critical, saying, "I don't worry about that, partly because I think that the Democratic Party has stayed pretty grounded in fact and reality. I think people like the passion that Bernie brought, but Bernie Sanders is a pretty centrist politician relative to Corbyn or relative to some of the Republicans." But what was clear to Obama remained resolutely invisible to many British voters. The gulf between the reality of Corbyn the man and public perception was still being masterfully navigated by Milne and Co., while the wisdom of keeping him out of studios as much as possible would shortly be rewarded in unexpected fashion. Put simply, the less people saw of him, the more his folk hero status grew on the back of vague promises of a kinder, gentler politics and undergraduate idealism. Most crucially, though, these were not normal circumstances. Theresa May's fool's errand of trying to deliver a Brexit that would satisfy a significant swathe of the people that voted for it was, inevitably, starting to come apart at the seams. The country was plunged into a ridiculous purgatory, where the absence of any settlement meant that the liars and charlatans could continue to promise the earth, while the millions of Remainers, already seeing much of Project Fear come true, had nowhere to turn, except, incredibly, to Jeremy Corbyn. On the 8th of June 2017, Theresa May went to the country in the hope of extending her working majority of 17 seats. After a decent set of local election results, the calculation was not as daft as it would later appear. Her advisers, including the ludicrous Nick Timothy, were overlooking one crucial factor. The vote would mark the first opportunity since 2016 for Remain voters to vote against a candidate dedicated to delivering Brexit. Consider the irony. May, a Remain voter and one of the few politicians to display a pre-referendum understanding of the danger posed by Brexit to the Good Friday Agreement, was the Brexit candidate, while Corbyn, a lifelong Leaver, was the only real option available to Remainers. This anomaly, mixed with Corbyn's appeal to cohorts routinely dubbed Dreamers and students, threw opinion polls and predictions into complete disarray and ultimately saw the Conservatives return 317 MPs, 13 fewer than in 2015, while Labour gained 30 seats, taking their total to 262. In percentage terms, May won 42.4% of the vote, the Conservatives' highest share since 1983, and Corbyn 40%, Labour's highest share since 2001. Inevitably, the political scientist John Curtis, doyen of cephologists, found that many of Labour's most successful results occurred in seats that had voted Remain by a large margin. "It seems to be the case," he wrote, "that Mrs. May's brand of Brexit may have helped to squeeze the UKIP vote, but at the same time, it put off some Remain voters." The result would leave both Theresa May's premiership and the Labour Party's hopes of winning the next election completely doomed, The former, because she was vulnerable to attacks from an opportunistic charlatan prepared to lie egregiously about Brexit. The latter, because the numbers gave Corbyn and his crew more than enough room to claim, absurdly, that Labour's third general election loss in a row was, somehow, a victory. Accordingly, he would not be resigning. When Gordon Brown trailed David Cameron's Tories by 48 seats after the 2010 election, Jeremy Corbyn wrote in the Morning Star that the result was disastrous for New Labour. When he found himself 55 seats behind Theresa May 7 years later, he said, "I think it's pretty clear who won this election." He was, incredibly, talking about himself. Just 2.5 years later, he would lead Labour to its worst general election defeat since 1935, securing less than a third of votes cast and returning just 202 MPs. Pollster Opinion found that among 2017 Labour voters who switched allegiance to another party, 37% of them cited Corbyn's leadership as their main reason. Despite this dismal figure, almost doubling the percentage who cited Brexit, he claimed that the election was taken over by Brexit. An extraordinary excuse given his own abject and repeated failure to make a compelling case for EU membership. Among Labour voters who switched allegiances to the Tories, 45% cited Corbyn's leadership as the main issue, with 29% of defectors from the Liberal Democrats saying the same. Of all the people polled who said they did not vote for the Labour Party, 43% said their main reason was the leadership, with 17% blaming Brexit and 12% Labour's economic policies. Another survey of 10,000 people conducted by the Brexiteer peer Lord Ashcroft found that 53% of those who deserted Labour between 2017 and 2019 did so because they did not want Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister. For some, as ever, this was nothing to do with Jeremy Corbyn. An internal report conducted by his own election coordinators, Ian Lavery and Andrew Gwynne, found that 4 years of unrelenting attacks on the character of the party leader, an assault without precedent in modern politics, had a degree of negative impact. For others, a man who had voted against his own party leadership in the House of Commons on more than 400 occasions was a victim of unconscionable disloyalty. By now, permanently high on his own supply, Corbyn would claim this time that, "I am proud that on austerity, on corporate power, on inequality and on the climate emergency, we have won the arguments and rewritten the terms of political debate." It is a statement of almost unbelievable arrogance and delusion, nouns that perfectly distill both the post-2017 period of his leadership and his remaining cheerleaders. As support drained away, so the purblind certainties of his remaining cultists increased. The pitiful performance of a general despised by his most senior troops and derided by opponents and reluctant supporters alike would remain forevermore the fault of somebody, anybody, everybody but him. Unfortunately for the country he had sought to govern, the full reality of what had actually been helped to power by Jeremy Corbyn's querulousness, stubbornness, and incompetence was about to become horribly clear. Even,